organizations that were out there were actually hacked by these crypto miners, and it's stealing a bunch of processing power off of your systems. So obviously, if your systems are being hijacked by the bad guys to crypto mine for them, then that's just less computing power that you end up having for yourself. And I have to say, there's a lot of organizations that run rather close to the wall with regards to horsepower and capabilities. So, you know, they're not necessarily buying computer systems that have a lot of excess capacity. So when there is something like this that adversely impacts performance, it actually ends up resulting in help desk tickets, like, gee, why is my computer so slow? And there's enough issues associated with simply updates happening. You know, when you're, let's say you get a major update on your computer, and that major update ends up replacing 10,000 files, or, you know, or more, then that is probably going to cause your computer to be slow for probably the next 12 to 24 hours as it kind of re-optimizes the file system after all of these huge changes that have gone on. And there's a lot of other things that can put demand on a system as well. And surprisingly, well, not surprisingly for people in the IT industry, but surprisingly for most other people, it is actually all your security protections that is really what puts a more significant demand on the computer system itself than what the end user puts on the computer system. Obviously, that kind of a statement is not true for your super mega heavy duty computer users, which tend to primarily be IT personnel. Outside of that, you know, maybe heavy duty graphics design artists or, you know, architects running CAD software, you get the idea. So this goes to this whole point of you can't be buying systems with this intent in mind of saying, well, I only need what it is for, you know, the horsepower for the things that I do. No, the reality is if you want your computer to not be hacked, you have to give your computer enough horsepower to run the protection programs as well. So back to this whole aspect of how do you prevent your computer from getting infected by a crypto jacking, crypto mining stuff? Well, the fact simply is it has to be at the network layer. When we try to do these sorts of protections with endpoint security agents, it really just doesn't work. Now, there are some endpoint security agents that have plugins for the web browser that have a certain level of efficacy, but it's just not 90%. It's maybe 10% of the solution. The other 90% of the solution is really a hardened, heavily managed network layer security solution. And you say, well, gee, that sounds expensive. Well, yeah, it is expensive. But look at it this way. And then you can determine, I'll give you some examples about what this might cost. And then you can determine whether it makes financial sense for you. So effectively, let's say you're going to get a perimeter security appliance. On the low end, we're talking like $1,500. On a higher end, maybe $3,500. It depends on whether you're talking about a residential implementation or you're talking about a business implementation. You know, some larger business implementations could be $5,000. You know, it really depends. And that's going to be just strictly on the hardware and the security subscription side. But then when we're really talking about the maintenance of this system, I would say at a minimum, you need to expect to budget at a minimum in a residential scenario, $500 a year for the maintenance of that thing. Because, you know, these are living, breathing things. We're talking about in excess of 40,000 new viruses getting generated every hour. So if you don't have a hardened security expert who's in an active relationship with managing that security appliance for you, then that layer of protection just, it diminishes in its efficacy over time. So the strategies that may have worked at the time of implementation are not necessarily the strategies that are the best approach 6 months later. A great example of this is all of this mess associated with deep packet inspection. And also this movement towards encrypted files being downloaded. So I'm not talking about things encrypted in transit, which we're all very familiar with, because every time you go to your bank website or every time you go to Amazon to shop, you're engaging in traffic that is encrypted in transit. That is not the same as a file itself that is an encrypted object being transferred between point A and point B. Now, deep packet inspection in general works for things that are transferred through a TLS encrypted tunnel, which is encrypted in transit. On the other hand, if the source file itself is encrypted and now it's getting downloaded, it doesn't really matter what the channel is that it's being downloaded over, whether we're talking FTP, HTTP, HTTPS. Really doesn't matter because the file itself is encrypted. So when a security appliance sees that, it says, well, that is an encrypted file. So I don't know what I can do with that. I can't see it. I can't get into it. I can't scan it for viruses. I can't scan it for ransomware. Why? Because it's encrypted. So the bad guys know that this is a way to evade security mechanisms. So you better believe that's exactly what they're using in terms of techniques. So this originally popped up maybe 9 months ago, really started to be an issue. And I had reached out to security appliance manufacturer at that time and said, hey, you guys really better put out some documentation making some strategic recommendations for the, average everyday IT people out there that are not certified security architects, so that they don't go and do something really stupid, which is if the file itself is determined to be encrypted, then just allow it. Now, the reason I say that would be an incredibly stupid approach is because this is exactly what the bad guys are doing with the content that they're trying to get bypassed the filtering mechanisms. But I know that the vast majority of IT people out there, certainly consulting firms, don't want support tickets. And so their way of not having support tickets is to have a default allow approach as opposed to a default deny approach. And in the reality, it is way easier to have true security with a default deny approach and allow only what it is that you have a certain level of trust over. There's some things you can implicitly trust, and so you use certain techniques for those. And then there's other things that maybe you have a marginal level of trust over, and again, you use different techniques for those. So there's these varying approaches, but to suggest that we're going to take a default allow approach is just ridiculously stupid beyond all belief. It's gross negligence as far as I'm concerned, because that technique has been proven irrefutably to just not work for 25 years. And you'd be laughed out of the room if you were at a security conference if that was the approach that you took. But yet, this is the approach that most IT consulting firms take because they don't want to have help desk tickets from their customers. So I contacted the security appliance manufacturer at that time and said, hey, I really think, this is rife for abuse, and there is a very easy way to deal with this if indeed the customer has legitimate encrypted files that need to be downloaded. There's a very simple way to deal with that, which is identify the source. So let's say, for example, you have a particular accounting application that reaches out to a payroll table source. And those payroll tables, maybe the way that they're delivered to your computer system is via encrypted files. Okay. Well, you can easily identify this and say, hey, that's a legitimate process that we have. We need to download these payroll tables. So then we just figure out what is that source that the application is communicating with in order to download those encrypted files, and then effectively whitelist that, meaning we're saying we implicitly trust that source to not be delivering us malware, ransomware, viruses, etc. So in that strategy, the best approach, if you're smart enough to do that, is to take a default deny approach, meaning if the file is encrypted, then block it, because we don't know what it is. You know, it could be anything. It could be a command and control remote access Trojan. You don't know. But it's certainly a much better approach to take this default deny strategy and then look at things that are getting blocked and then make an assessment of them, as opposed to trying to clean up the mess once an incident has occurred. In excess of 50% of businesses that have a security breach end up going out of business. They end up going bankrupt because there's no amount of cybersecurity insurance that is going to cover that. The cybersecurity insurance, even if you have it, is not a business continuity plan. It's effectively a reimbursement mechanism. So first off, you'd have to come up with the money to pay for the mitigation and the remediation. And how long is that even going to take? And can you even process service to your customers in that interim? Usually the answer is no. And so that's why 50% of businesses that incur an incident end up going out of business. So it seems to me that if what you're really trying to do is ensure that your organization stays up and functioning, it really is an approach where, yes, we might incur a temporary inconvenience of having something legitimate blocked, but that is a very, very short period of time to deal with that issue. I mean, an hour or less, as opposed to, well, we've taken this really brain dead approach of default allow, and then now we're going to try and clean up the mess after some horrendous breach has occurred. So something like that is exactly why you have to be working with a security architect professional who is going to stay on top of these things, because the bad guys are changing their techniques all the time. And if your mitigation and prevention techniques do not agilely move and adapt to their new strategies, it's just you're not going to be maintaining the value of the financial investment that you've already made. So, you know, for a typical business, you might want to set aside $2,000 to $3,000 annually for maintenance work on a security appliance. You know, we're not talking about massive sums of money here. And when you look at what a single outage is going to cost you, it would be multifold of that. So for a lot of people, including the residential market, this really makes sense. And then this ties into another topic I wanted to talk about, which is the whole tech support scams where they're using browser lockers, where it like locks up your browser and it beeps and it flashes things at you. Those scams are back, and they're back in force. And the people that I have seen who have been presented these scams all have the same thing in common. They're not using a perimeter security appliance. Yet I can tell you that I have yet to have a report by anyone who was protected by a properly programmed perimeter security appliance that they encountered that. So effectively, we're talking about a direct relationship here. Either you have the security appliance and you're protected, or you don't have the security appliance and you're not protected, and it's leaving you open to things like crypto miners, crypto jackers, browser lockers, tech support scam, things like that. And maybe that's a risk you wish to accept, and that's fine. I just hope that you're making an informed decision about it. All right, let's move on to Office 365 tenant branding and why it's so darned important for security. And most people just don't realize this. They think that tenant branding is something that is a marketing thing, like, oh, let's put our logo on our Office 365 tenant. I would argue that there's a massive security improvement aspect to tenant branding customization, because what it can do for you is present your end users the correct content that helps them know that they're at the correct login the correct login portal. Maybe a little window here, a little pop-up there, maybe a web page there. You know, there's a variety of ways in which you can log into Office 365. You could be on your iPhone. You could be in a web browser. You could be inside the OneDrive client, or you could be inside the Skype for Business client. Depending upon which way it is that you're logging into Office 365, you will be presented different login boxes, and they will look different. Now, unless you've done tenant branding customizations, now, and there are techniques for this that are better than others. For example, just slapping some logos in there is not what I would advocate as a security facilitating technique. If you're interested in really finding out about this, you know, contact me via the website. But when this is customized correctly, all of your end users know that they're in the right spot. And this really makes a huge difference. Can't tell you how many times I've had people tell me that they got taken in and scammed by a particular email and they clicked on a link and it took them to what pretended to be an Office 365 login page because this page was trying to steal their credentials. But because they knew that they had had a tenant branding customization performed by QPC, that it didn't look the way that it would normally look to them. So they were, you know, it was thrown up a little suspicious, saying, well, I don't see the right images there. I don't see the right fonts. I don't see the right accompanying text. So therefore, I'm pretty sure this is not a legitimate Office 365 login window. So that's a big deal. And if you have Office 365 and you have not engaged in tenant branding customization, please do look into that. It's not some sort of a huge thing to do. It's depending upon what has to be done to your branding images that you want to put in there. It could be anywhere from an hour to 3 hours of work. Again, not a huge amount of time. So there's really, you know, you shouldn't look at that and go like, oh, well, you know, having this extra security is cost prohibitive. Well, that's just baloney, because it's a one-time investment of time. And it really is that visual indicator to all of your team that they're in the right place. So therefore, they should be trained to only put their Office 365 login credentials into logon boxes that look legitimate. All right, so the next topic has to do with Facebook and the evils of Facebook, specifically the Daily Mail out of the UK did this great article, which I'm linking into the page associated with this podcast. They did this great article where they were talking about how Facebook is collecting creepy levels of privacy invading, spying data, even on people that are not Facebook users. Now, years ago, I talked about the fact that Facebook's end user license agreement states very clearly all the things that they can do with you and how you have no rights whatsoever if you sign up for a Facebook account, because the Facebook account is free. So therefore, they are effectively turning you into cattle with an identity that they can then sell and exploit. It's an extremely perverted, one-sided legal agreement. And so as a result, tons of us don't have any Facebook accounts. Like, I don't have a Facebook account, and we'll never sign up for it. But this article at the Daily Mail went into additional detail talking about how, because of the fact that Facebook is injecting their cookies, their spyware tracking cookies, into so many websites, that they're able to aggregate a profile of people that are not even Facebook users. And then they're able to actually utilize that data to show you customized adverts and other things, even though you're not actually a Facebook user. So I'm going to let you read that article on your own, but I will tell you that there's actually a fairly straightforward way for you to stop all this baloney from occurring, which is just get a perimeter security appliance, get it properly programmed, and shut down Facebook. If you're not a Facebook user and you don't need to have access to it, then shut it down, because it is pervasive. It's absolutely pervasive. And the junk from Yahoo is pervasive as well. I mean, I can tell you that on my network, Yahoo and Facebook are 100% outright blacked. But yet, every single day in the security reports that I get, it talks about how many times, as I was browsing to a particular website, Facebook and Yahoo were trying to load junk content and present it to me, as well as implementing tracking and spyware cookies on my systems. So again, my systems are immune to this junk simply because of the fact that I've got a properly programmed perimeter security appliance in place and it does its job. But if you don't have something like that, then you're really kind of left, you know, out in the open about that. All right, let's move on to something that was pretty shocking, actually, and highly entertaining and scary all simultaneously, which is the latest TrustyCo debacle. There is a company called TrustyCo, and they had a reseller agreement with Symantec for certificates. And I'm sure many of you have heard about Komodo as a certificate provider. Komodo sells certificates really cheap, but, and this is my professional opinion, I think their certificates are junk, because I have tried many, many times to utilize their certificates and they don't work. You can't get them to actually work on a Linux server properly. There's conversion problems. Their tech support is not great. So really, in the grand scheme of things, when you look at it and say, well, gee, I could get a certificate for, you know, $100. No, you actually can't, because you can buy it and it won't work. You know, or if it takes you 6 hours to get the thing to work, when really it should have only taken you 30 minutes to work, how much did that certificate, that supposedly cheap certificate, actually cost you? Well, this debacle with TrustyCo is centered around how they used to have this relationship with Symantec, and Symantec was not doing the greatest job of being a certificate authority. They had some issues, and that's probably simply because Symantec is one of those giant behemoths of a company that doesn't do anything well. And I've railed previously against Symantec as far back as the year 2000. They literally blew up their prime backup product that was great. They just blew it up. And it was simply because people in these behemoth companies tend to get way too disconnected from their true user base, and they get off of their mission and more onto bean counting. And there's nothing wrong with bean counting as long as it's not the primary a decision-making factor. Fundamentally, if you're in the technology business, the primary decision-making factor has to be engineering efficacy towards the solution. So TrustyCo did not want to continue to have these certificates that Symantec had issued, and it came about where these certificates from Symantec were announced by Google, that Google said, we're not going to trust these certificates anymore because of the issues, the poor mismanagement of Symantec, effectively. And a month and some days after Google made that announcement, DigiCert, which actually is probably the best certificate authority in the world for the mid-market, you know, VeriSign tends to be the best provider for the, you know, super large enterprise. But DigiCert bought Symantec's web security business, and so then they took over as the CA for all of Symantec's previously issued certificates. And TrustyCo did not want to be into this relationship, and they wanted to somehow get their hands untied, and they didn't want to follow the rules. So the CEO of TrustyCo did something really quite evil, which was he took the private keys, which technically he shouldn't have even had. He took the private keys for 23,000 certificates and published them to the internet. And this forced DigiCert to revoke the associated certificates within 24 hours because that's part of the CA industry rules. Now, of course, if TrustyCo would not have breached the private keys of these certificates themselves, then none of this baloney would have happened. And then TrustyCo went on Twitter and said some trash, and DigiCert basically came back with the facts and put them under the table. Then some security people got involved and said, hey, what is up with this injection attack on the TrustyCo website? So there was literally an injection attack going on TrustyCo's website, and all these people started looking into it and saying, well, gee, why does TrustyCo even have the private keys? Why would they be so irresponsible as to leak these private keys? So what fundamentally ended up being basically a peeing match between two companies ended up harming 23,000 of TrustyCo's company customers. But I think the lesson for all of us is that you should never be making procurement decisions based upon price. You should be making procurement decisions based upon total value. And in this context, the total value that a company like DigiCert, who has been a premier high-quality certificate provider, employing only really highly skilled engineers on the support side and the maintenance and management side, that's really who you want to be doing business with in terms of as a certificate provider. Buying things from Komodo just because they're cheap, not a good idea. Certainly buying things from Symantec, not a good idea because it wasn't their core business. It's kind of like the ridiculousness of Valeant, how they went on this buying spree and bought up over 100 other pharmaceutical companies in a period of a few years, and so was Valeant actually really paying any attention to the product line of any of these acquired companies? No, absolutely not. So, I mean, do we actually think that Symantec was doing a good job of taking care of their web security business? Well, the evidence would say otherwise, because why did they have certificate problems? So, it was highly entertaining and it's really interesting. I enjoy how, in some cases, not in all cases, but in some cases, Twitter is a great way for companies to kind of publicly vindicate themselves with proof and screenshots of things and publish a rebuttal to an accusation and clear their name. And I think DigiCert did a great job in this case. And I hope a lot of people come out of this whole debacle as saying, boy, TrustyCo is really not a business that we want to do business with anymore, especially if the CEO of the organization was going to violate the trust of 23,000 customers and take the private keys of their certificates and publish them. And which, effectively broke 23,000 websites or 23,000 things that had had those certificates on there at a minimum. And usually certificates are placed in more than one thing. So it wasn't just 23,000. That's a lot of havoc to create. And I thought it was very irresponsible. All right, that's it for today's show.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com. Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Union Grove-based BSW Farm with a selection of lamb, beef, bison, and goat. Antibiotic and hormone-free. The market is open at the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha, Saturdays from 10 until 2.
Support for WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus. Since 1931, Piasecki Althaus has provided unmatched, compassionate service and are dedicated to your family, guests, and supporting the community. Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, honoring personal legacies and the circle of life. 262-658-4101.
Support comes from the free concert series Fine Arts at First, presenting the Merling Trio this Sunday at 3. The violin, cello, and piano ensemble will perform a mix of classical works and selections from the Great American Songbook at First United Methodist Church on Sheridan at 60th. This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters. The